Beloved, was a time when I knew peace in your presence. Though, to be truthful with myself, there were as many times when your presence plunged me into deadliest danger, or pain, or fear. But the peace is what I remember and long for. Were you here, I would seize you by the shoulders and shake you until your teeth rattled. What is the meaning of this truncated message you have sent me? Did you fear to entrust too much information? Did you suspect how cruelly your messenger would be hunted, or how she would suffer such a tortured death? What need could compel you to knowingly risk her to such a fate? I ask myself that, and the only answer I can find is that if you did not, she would face a worse one. What, I ask myself, could be worse? And then I wonder what sort of danger you yourself are in right now, that you did not bring this message yourself. All I have are questions, and each one is a torment to me at a time when I am overwhelmed by other concerns. You have set me a mysterious task with few clues. I fear it is an essential one, but just as essential are those already in my hands. The raising of my daughter. Shall I again abandon my own child, this time to go in search of yours? Too little information, old friend, and too large a sacrifice. Unfinished letter from the desk of Fitzchivalry Farseer.
I stood alone in my room and listened to Shun shrieking out in the hallway. Bitterness rose in me. After all I had gone through tonight with him, all I had done to help him, one cry from her, and my father ran off and left me standing in the semi-dark in soggy clothing. I pushed the lid of the chest up higher and strained to reach the bottom and, by touch, discover something dry and comfortable I would wear to bed. I pushed past winter socks and itchy wool shirts. My fingertips touched something, and then I got hold of it and pulled it up from the bottom of the chest. It was a warm felted nightrobe, red, my favorite color. I carried it closer to the fire to look at it. It was new and unworn. I turned the collar inside out and knew the stitches. My mother had made this, for me. Made it and set it aside, as she had so often done, to be pulled out the moment I outgrew my old one. I shed my wet garments where I stood and pulled the new nightrobe on over my head. It fit well, save that it was a bit long. I lifted it to walk. It made me feel elegant to have to catch up my skirt when I walked, even if it was only the train of my nightrobe. The ghost cried out, a long, distant wail that lifted the hair on the back of my head. I stood frozen for an instant. Then it came again, closer and louder. Two things happened in that moment. I knew I should never have left a cat in the spy maze, and I abruptly deduced that, yes, my chamber did have an entrance to the secret corridors. It just wasn't where I thought it would be. I pushed open the door to the maidservant's room. The firelight barely reached inside. I went back for a candle. The pale stranger's bedding was as she had left it, crumpled on the bed. I knew better than to touch it. I edged around it, and as I did, my feet tangled in something, and I nearly fell. I cried out in fear of the infected bedding, and the ghost cried in response. "Just a minute," I hissed low. "I'm coming. Be quiet, and I'll give you a big piece of fish." Water. The cat wanted water. I should have known that. He'd already found and claimed his salt fish reward, and now he was thirsty. "Water, then, and sausage from the pantry. But be quiet until I can get to you, please." A rumbling meow of agreement and warning. If his reward was slow in coming, he was going to sing the stones down around me. Heart thundering, I looked down at my feet, fearing to see a flood of biting insects climbing my legs. Instead, I saw only the hem of my nightrobe and, when I lifted it, my bare feet against the plank floor. Holding my robe high and bringing my candle close, I stooped. I stared. I could feel that my foot was on top of something that was not the floor, but I couldn't see anything there. I hiked my robe higher so I could grip the hem in my teeth and curled my toes. They clasped fabric, light and soft. I reached down and pinched it between my forefinger and thumb, and as I did, a flap of it fell over, revealing once more the butterfly wing pattern on the underside. I dropped it, startled, and again my foot was apparently bare against the floor, but half of my toes were gone. One corner of the cloak was upturned to show the delicate panes of colour. As I stared in astonishment, my toes slowly formed on the fabric. I could feel that the cloth covered them, but I could not see them. I pinched the butterfly colour part of the cloak up between my thumb and forefinger and stood. Now I could see it. It hung from my uplifted hand, a garment of riotous colour and very little weight. This, then, was how we had not seen her in the bed. The strange words of the messenger came back to me. It takes on the colours and shadows. No wonder she had cautioned us not to discard it. It was a treasure from an old tale. Abruptly, my fear of contagion vanished, to be replaced with the certainty that if my father saw this, he would take it from me and probably destroy it to protect me. I set my candle on the floor and, standing carefully free of the bedding's touch, shook out the cloak and folded it, butterfly side out. It made a surprisingly small packet. I thought to myself that such thin fabric would be delicate and of small use against wind or rain. I resolved to take great care with it. Stripey Cat meowed again. "Hush!" I cautioned him. Then I suggested, "Dig or scratch where you see my light. I'm trying to find the door." The faint scrabbling came from under the bed. I didn't want to touch the bed frame, but I did. I seized it in both hands and with an effort pulled the heavy bed away from the wall. It seemed to me that it was much heavier than it needed to be, and I suspect it had been made so just to discourage a servant from moving it. I lifted my candle and edged past the bed frame to the wall to peer and poke at the wooden panels. The cat clawed diligently, even frantically. I could not see an opening or trigger, but when I put my hand where he was scratching, I felt a draught. And the sound, it seemed to me, was much louder than it should have been. "Be patient," I warned him again, and suddenly thought of the door in the study. I shut the door to the room and studied the hinges. No false hinges, but there was one plank of wood behind the door that was narrower than its fellows. I caught my nails in the edge of it and tugged at it till it swung out. Behind it was a lever covered in cobwebs and spotted with rust. I pulled it, and it groaned. It did not travel far, but a section of wall behind the bed suddenly moved out of alignment. The cat's excited meow was louder now. "Shush!" I warned him. I suspected I had very little time until my father returned. I needed to hide my cloak, reward and banish the cat, and be back in my room before I was missed. I returned the narrow panel to its place, gritted my teeth, and edged around the contaminated bed. When I leaned on the displaced wall panel, it swung in. I stepped inside, pushing the cat back with my foot. "Don't go out here. There's no water here," I warned him. He growled, but backed away. I tucked the cloak under my arm, set down my candle, and used every bit of my strength to pull the bed back into place. That done, I stepped into the secret corridor and pushed the concealed door closed behind me. Cat first, I decided, and he was pleased that I did so. "Take us back to the pantry," I suggested in a whisper. "To the fish." Stripey led, and I followed. Twice he stopped so abruptly that I nearly trod on him. But he knew the way, and we reached the concealed door in the pantry and together emerged there. I had to pile up boxes to reach a fine string of sausages hung out of our reach. Again, I wished for a belt knife. I had to bite two of the sausages free of their fellows. The cat called piteously, reminding me it was water he craved most. Together, we ventured into the kitchen, where I found water for him, He drank and drank while I examined my butterfly cloak. The fabric seemed to be much sturdier than its light weight would indicate. When Stripey had finished drinking, I rewarded him with the sausage and let him carry it out into the kitchen yard. He was padding away into the night when I called after him. "What about the rats? Did you kill any?" He had killed several and discovered and made an end of two nests of babies. "Will you come back tomorrow?" It wasn't likely. He hadn't liked being confined with no water. He was accustomed to coming and going as he pleased. He trotted away, tail high, into the cold night. I could scarcely blame him. I'd left him trapped and waterless for hours. But his discovery of two nests of baby rats was something I could not ignore. I would have to find a feline ally, and soon. I heard a whisper of sound from the house and suddenly recalled that I needed to hurry. I darted back into the pantry, just as I heard someone come into the kitchen. I pinched my candle out, and by touch, found my way into the secret corridor. I drew the door shut behind me. The dark became absolute. I promised myself that I now knew my way well enough that I needed no light. I tried not to think of any rats Stripey had not killed. It took me a time, but I groped my way back to the small cubby that looked down into my father's study. A tiny beam of light was coming in the peephole. I peered out, and I saw my father move to close the study doors. In a moment, he'd open the door. In the dark, I shook out my butterfly cloak and then refolded it so that the invisible side was out. I could not see what I was doing. I hoped I had left no betraying edge of colour showing. As I heard him open the panel door, I hid my cloak on the shelf behind the candle supply. The dance of his candlelight preceded him. Light and liquid shadows flowed and spread. They came around the corner like a wave of water and engulfed me. I sat quietly, my extinguished candle in hand, until he reached me. As the light touched me and he saw me, I heard the sigh of relief he expelled.
"I thought I might find you here," he said gently.
Then as he looked at me,
"Oh, my dear, did your candle go out too? Such a night it has been for you, my poor little cub."
He had to crouch to be in my hidey-hole. When I stood, he bent deeper to kiss me where my hair parted. He was still for a moment, as if he was smelling me.
"Are you all right?"
I nodded.
"Is this where you want to come when you are frightened?"
That I could answer truthfully. "Yes. This place is mine, more than anywhere else in Withy Woods." He straightened and nodded back at me.
"Very well."
He tried to roll his shoulders, but could not in the cramped space.
"Come with me now. We both need to get some sleep before dawn."
He led the way and I followed him out of the secret corridors and back into his den. I watched him close the panel and open the tall doors. I followed his candle as we went back to the main part of Withy Woods. At the foot of the grand staircase, he halted. He turned and looked down at me.
"Your room will need to be thoroughly cleaned before you can sleep there again. And my room is too untidy. I suggest we sleep in your mother's sitting room, where you were born."
He did not wait for me to agree. I followed him as we went to the pleasant chamber that had once served as a nursery for me. It was cold and dark. My father lit a branch of candles and left me there while he went to get a scoop of coals from another hearth to start a fire. While he was gone, I brushed cobwebs from my new red nightdress. I stared about my mother's dimly lit room. We had not spent much time here since she had died. Her presence was everywhere, from the candles ready in their holders to the emptied flower vases. No, not her presence. It was her absence that I felt. Last winter, the three of us had gathered here almost every night. My mother's work basket was still by her chair. I sat down in it and set the basket on my lap. I pulled my feet up under my nightgown and hugged the basket to me.
Chapter 19. The Beaten Man. And in a time that no one expects, when hope is dead and white prophets fled, in a place where he cannot be found, there will be discovered the unexpected son. He will not be known to his father, and motherless he will grow. He will be the pebble in the track that shifts the wheel from its course. Death will thirst for him, but time and again that thirst will go unslaked. Buried and lifted, forgotten, unnamed, in isolation and disgrace, he will yet prevail in the hand of the white prophet who wields him without compassion or mercy for the tool that must be dulled and chipped to shape a better world. I set the scroll aside, wondering why I had bothered to take it out. I had brought it from my private den to Molly's room, where B lay sleeping. It was the only bit of writing I'd ever read that mentioned the prophecy of the unexpected son. And it was only a fragment. There were no new answers to the question I wanted to ask him. Why, after all these years? Why such a message and such a messenger? I turned it over, studying it for the thousandth time. It was an old piece of something. Not vellum, not paper. Neither shade nor I knew what it was. The ink was very black, the edges of each letter sharp. The substance it was written on was pliable, and the colour of honey. If I held it up to the fire, I could see light through it. Neither Shade nor I could read it, but it came with a translation that Shade assured me was accurate. At the time, he had muttered something like, "At that price, it had better be accurate." The first time I had seen it, I was still a lad, and it was one of a number of scrolls and vellums that Shade was collecting on the topic of white prophets and their predictions. I paid no more mind to this than I did to his fascination with elderberry propagation and creating a poison from rhubarb leaves. Shade had many obsessions during those years. I think his fixations were all that had kept him sane during his decades of isolated spying. I certainly didn't connect his fascination with white prophets to King Shrewd's peculiar jester. In those days, the fool was merely the fool to me, a pasty-faced, skinny child with colourless eyes and a double-edged tongue. I avoided him mostly. I had seen him frolic through the tumbler's tricks that could make the court gasp. I hadn't yet heard him slice a man's pride to ribbons with his razor-sharp sarcasm and clever wordplay. Even after fate introduced us, first as acquaintances and then as friends, I did not make the connection. Years would pass before the fool confided to me that he thought the prophecies about the unexpected son were foretelling my birth. It was one of half a hundred bits of predictions that he had quilted together. And then he had come to find me, his catalyst, the bastard son of an abdicated king in a distant northern land. And together, he had assured me, we would change the future of the world. He believed I was the unexpected son. There had been times when he was so insistent on it that I almost believed it myself. Certainly, death had thirsted for me, and often enough he had intervened to snatch me away from that fate at the last possible moment. Ultimately, I had done the same for him. We had achieved his goal, the restoration of dragons to the world, and in doing so, had ended his days as a white prophet. And he had left me, severing decades of friendship and departing to return whence he had come. Clarez, a town somewhere far to the south, or perhaps it was just the name of the school where he had been raised. For all the time that we'd spent together, he'd told me precious little of his life before I'd known him. And when he thought it was time for us to part, he'd left. He'd given me no choice in that matter, and steadfastly refused my offer to go with him. He had feared, he told me, that I would continue to act as a catalyst, and that together we might unknowingly undo all we had wrought. And so he had gone, and I had never truly said farewell to him. The knowledge that he had left me with no intent ever to return
had come to me in tiny droplets of realization spread over the years, and each droplet of comprehension brought its own small measure of hurt. In the months that had followed my return to Buckkeep, I had discovered that finally, suddenly, I had my own life. That was a giddying experience. He had wished me well in finding my own fate to follow, and I never doubted his sincerity. But it had taken me years to accept that his absence in my life was a deliberate finality, an act he had chosen, a thing completed even as some part of my soul still dangled, waiting for his return. That, I think, is the shock of any relationship ending. It is realizing that what is still an ongoing relationship to someone is, for the other person, something finished and done with. For some years I waited, like a faithful dog told to sit and stay. I had had no reason to believe that the fool had lost affection or regard for me. Yet the ringing silence and constant absence began, over time, to feel like dislike or, worse, indifference. There had been times, over the years, when I had dwelled on it. I tried to excuse it. I had been missing when he passed through Buckkeep Town. Many had feared me dead. Had he? My answer to that had danced back and forth. He had left me a gift, the carved statue of him, Night Eyes, and me. Would he leave a gift that he never expected to be claimed? Well, what else would he have done with it? There were words hidden in the carved memory stone, a single sentence. I have never been wise. Did that mean he would be foolish enough to renew our friendship, even if it meant chancing the undoing of our work? Or did it mean that in his foolishness, he would set out on a dangerous quest without me? Did it mean he had been a fool ever to care about me beyond my role as his catalyst? Was it an apology that he had seemed to care for me and let me come to rely so deeply on our bond? Had he ever truly cared about our friendship? There are always those dark thoughts, I must believe, when a deep friendship ends so abruptly. But every wound becomes a scar, eventually. That one never entirely ceased being tender, but I had learned to live with it. It did not intrude on me every moment. I had a home, a family, a loving wife, and then a child to raise with her. And though Molly's death had reawakened those echoes of loss and abandonment, I did not think I had been dwelling on it. Then the messenger arrived, and a message so poorly conveyed or badly constructed that it made little sense. She had hinted that there had been other messengers who had not reached me. A memory stirred. All those years ago, a girl messenger and three strangers, blood on the floor and bloody fingerprints on the fool's face. That scream. I felt dizzied and sick. My heart hurt as if someone had squeezed it. What message had I missed all those years ago? What death had that messenger endured that night? The fool had not forsaken or ignored me. Years ago, he had reached out for me. To warn me, or to beg for help? I had missed his message and let it go unanswered. Suddenly, that hurt me more than all the years of thinking he had abandoned our friendship. The thought that he had vainly waited for years for some sort of response from me was a razor-edged pain. But I did not know how to reach him now, or how to begin on this quest he had set for me. And I had no idea where to search for his son, or what sort of person I would be seeking. I pushed the thought from my mind. I needed sleep, at least a little sleep, before the dawn came. But there was the killing. Ironic that the one person who had understood how little I wanted to continue as an assassin had been involved in forcing my return to that profession. I did not regret my decision. I remained absolutely certain it had been the correct one. But I resented that I'd had to make such a choice, and was deeply agitated that my child had been forced to witness me disposing of a body, and to bear the burden of keeping that secret. When Shun's ghost hysteria was settled,
and after I had moved my sleeping child from Molly's chair to a couch, I had fetched a blanket from my bed and the bit of writing, thinking to study it one more time. But it was worse than useless. I concealed it beneath some forgotten mending in Molly's sewing basket and looked around her placid room. The fire was down to coals. I fed it. I took a pillow from her chair and felt guilty about putting the pretty thing on the floor. I lay down in front of the fire and flipped and kicked at the blanket until it somewhat covered me. The stitches of Molly's embroidery on the cushion pressed into my cheek. I resolved to put all questions and fears out of my head and to just sleep. For now, there was no immediate threat to me and mine. I had no idea what to do about the peculiar message, and there was nothing I could do about Shun's dramatics. I closed my eyes and emptied my mind. Clean snow falling on a wooded hillside. I took a deep, steadying breath and told myself there was a hint of deer scent in the crisp wind. I smiled. Do not agonize about yesterday. Do not borrow tomorrow's trouble. Let your heart hunt. Rest in the now. I filled my lungs slowly, and as slowly, let the air out. I drifted to a place, not sleeping, not waking. I was a wolf on a snowy hillside, taking in deer scent, and living only in the now.
Fitz!
No.
Fitz! I know you're awake!
I'm not, really. My mind drifted against shades, a boat tethered to a dock. I more than wanted to be asleep. I needed to be asleep, to float freely away on that current. I felt him sigh in annoyance.
Very well, but tomorrow, remember this is more than a dream. I'm sending the lad to you. They beat him badly, and if the city guard hadn't chanced upon the scene and chased them off, it's likely they would have killed him. But he's well enough to ride, or will be, in a few more days, and I think my best course is to send him away from Buckkeep as soon as possible.
The wind-swept winter forest had vanished. I opened my eyes. There was the smell of smoke and burning flesh on my hands and shirt. I should have washed, and found a nightshirt instead of sleeping in my clothes. I was too tired. Too tired of all of it to do any of it right. If I'd reported to you like that when I was 12, you'd have called me an idiot and hit me with something.
That's probably true, but I've been trying to reach you for hours. What made you put up your wall so stoutly? I began to think you'd taken my advice and sealed yourself against the skill whenever you were sleeping.
Probably something I should do. I hadn't even been aware I'd put my walls up, but suddenly knew when I'd done it. Keeping my walls up around B was a habit, but I'd always left a chink for deliberate skilling. I suppose it had been old instinct to raise them to full resistance during the kill. I'd wanted no chance witnesses to that. Easing into sleep must have lowered them. I told him half a truth.
I was preoccupied with Shun. She believes in ghosts and thought her room was haunted by some unfortunate child from her past. Evidently, he got the poison that had been meant for her. Not her fault. But when she hears a strange noise at night, it's hard to convince her of that. Is she all right?
Anxiety thrummed in his skilling.
Much better than the beaten lad, whoever he is. Fitz Vigilant, who else might I be sending to you to save him from being murdered?
I don't know.
Anyone who it pleased you to send my way, I suspect.
My weariness was making me testy, and it was coming to me now in pieces that this news meant I was about to have another orphan on my doorstep. Another addition to my household, one that would be underfoot for years rather than days or months. Another room to prepare, another horse in my stable, another plate on my table, another person speaking to me when I wanted to be left alone. I tried to muster some sympathy for the poor bastard.
So, his legitimate brothers have come to court, and his mother wishes to do away with their father's byblow. Not exactly. She seems to be a woman who plans ahead. Her boys will not come to court until next spring, and so I thought I might safely keep him here for a time longer. Evidently, she decided to be rid of him sooner rather than later, and is clever enough to attempt it in a way that will not make other folk think her sons were involved. The men she set on him were common ruffians, native to Buckkeep Town. They waylaid him outside a tavern.
Are you sure, then, that this wasn't just a random robbery?
I'm sure. The drubbing was too thorough and too violent. He was down and they could have easily taken his purse and run. They went past knocking him down, past knocking the fight out of him. This was personal, Fitz.
Cold seethed through his voice. Personal. The lady had made it personal, attempting to kill a boy under Lord Shade's protection. There would be some sort of repercussion for her, I did not doubt. I would not ask what it would be, or who would carry it out. Would she enter her bedchamber to find it ransacked and her most precious jewelry stolen? Or would it be crueler? I suspected she should keep a tight watch on her sons, or she might find out how it felt to have someone under her protection take a bad beating. Shade could be that cold. I could not. Tonight had brought back all my distaste for killing. Call it vengeance or justice, no matter how it was named, I wanted none of it. Never again. A bit of true sympathy for Fitzvigilant invaded my soul. Beaten past his ability to fight back. I didn't like to dwell on that. I had too many memories of situations of that sort.
Is anyone accompanying him? To see he gets here safely. He hasn't left yet. I've hidden him. And when I send him, he will have to travel alone. But I would not have decided to send him if I hadn't thought he'd be well enough to ride. He had 3 days of convalescing out of sight of any who might wish to harm him. He has vanished to other eyes. My hope is to make his father's wife believe she has terrified him enough to make him flee from Buckkeep Castle. She may be content with that, but I need to keep him past the time when she might have people watching for him to flee.
And if she has not given up by then? If she has watchers and they follow?
She will first have a task to find him, and those she sends to look may well find something else entirely.
A pause in his thoughts, and a small hum of cat pleasure. I filled it in for him.
And if she finds where you have sent him, she will still have to get past me.
Exactly.
So much satisfaction. I was so tired that even the tingle of pride I felt at his confidence in me was annoying.
Are you sure that you have not overestimated my ability to shepherd these lost lambs you are sending me?
Not at all. I regard your ability as second only to my own.
I stifled the thought that Shan had nearly been poisoned and Fitzvigilant had been severely beaten in Shade's care. Second only to his own. Oh, yes. I yawned widely enough that my jaw cracked. I tried to keep my mind on what he was telling me.
And what does Lord Vigilant think of this, of his lady trying to eliminate his bastard eldest?
There was just the briefest hesitation.
The man has no honour. He is not as attached to the lad as the boy deserves. He would, I think, be relieved. If, indeed, he knows of his lady's plotting. If he does not, I intend to see that he is fully informed. He will be made to care for the boy's safety before I have finished with either of them.
So, Shade had that end of the situation well in hand. At least that had not been maneuvered into my area of responsibility.
I'll let you know when he gets here. And now I have to sleep.
Fitz, are you all right?
The skill conveys emotion as well as thought when one is careless. Genuine concern. He was reading my pain. I pushed him gently away. I didn't want to answer the question. I was emphatically not all right. and he was the last person I wished to discuss that with.
I'm very tired. House guests, house repairs, and it's not the time of year when we should be doing these repairs. I should have done them last summer. Well, yes, that will teach you not to put things off. And the little one, how is she adapting? B is fine, Shade, just fine, and I'm going to sleep. Now.
I pushed him firmly out of my mind, forming my walls up behind him. There was no returning to sleep, and all peace had fled. I watched the shadows from the fire on the ceiling of the room. I tried to think about Molly, without the sadness, but that wound was still too fresh. I refused to think about the messenger or puzzle any more on her message. But refusing to think about a thing only brings it more strongly to mind. I thought of the fool. I tried to pretend I wasn't angry at him for sending such a cryptic message. I couldn't, so I stopped thinking about him. I rolled to my side and looked at my little girl. Her hair stuck up at all angles. She was huddled into a ball, like a sleeping cub. Her blanket had twisted away from her, and I could see that even her little toes were curled in tight to her feet. Sleeping small, hoping to stay hidden. Oh, little one. So small, but not as young as anyone else thought. Especially not after tonight. I'd done that to her. Without thinking, I'd made her my accomplice, just as Shade had done with me. Years from now, would I be reaching out to her as Shade did to me? Was I repeating yet another cycle, raising an apprentice assassin? Was it the only sort of fathering I knew how to do? The fool had always asserted that time moved in a great circle, but a decaying one, where at every turning, humanity repeated mistakes, making them ever graver. He had believed he could use me as his catalyst to set that great wheel into a better track. He'd had visions of the futures, and out of all the possible futures he could see, there had been one, a future in which I survived, and together we changed the world. And I was back to thinking of the fool again. I shifted again and rose. I built up the fire, tucked the blanket more closely around B, and then left as silently as a stalking assassin. Amazing how adept I was at that talent. I moved through Withywoods, carrying a branch of candles. I inspected the work that had been done so far in the Yellow Suite, and once more wondered at the temerity of a person who would come as a desperate guest to someone's home and then complain endlessly about the accommodations. But these rooms at least she must love. Earlier in the day, a fire of applewood and cedar had been kindled in the hearth to freshen the room. The fragrance lingered. In the candlelight, the yellow walls were a warm gold. When the newly freshened hangings were restored to the bed and the curtains rehung, it would be a cozy retreat for any young woman. Surely, she could not imagine a ghost in this warm and welcoming room. I shut the heavy wooden door behind me, comforted that at least this must go right tomorrow. Today, I amended. Today. Dawn was a broken dream away. Beyond the yellow suite was the green suite. I could not recall the last time I had been in those rooms. I opened the door and looked into dimness. Draped furniture breathed dust. Shuttered windows. The hearth was swept clean and had been cold for years. The bed frame was a skeleton, the hanging stored in a cedar chest at its foot. The room had an unused air, but I saw no rodent droppings. I would put the servants to making it habitable tomorrow. By the time Fitzvigilant arrived, the rooms would have warmed through. It was not as spacious as the Yellow Suite. Still, there was a little study off the bedchamber and a small room for a servant attached to it. I wondered if he would require one. Was I supposed to supply one? So much I did not know about having a scribe. I would ask Revel. Perhaps he would know. But yes, these rooms would do for Fitzvigilant. One more matter solved. Then B's rooms, and here I found a task I must do. Tomorrow I must feign anger about vermin, and demand that bedding be burned and the room scrubbed. That meant that tonight I must remove B's precious things to keep them safe from too thorough a cleansing. There were candles to gather, and her jumping jack and top, and other small items I thought might be precious to her. I took them and hid them in my own bedchamber in the trunk that locked. For no reason except that I couldn't sleep, I went down to the kitchen. The kitchens at Withywood's were smaller and far less busy than those at Buckkeep Castle, but the smells of the bread dough rising and a broth in a covered vat barely simmering at the back of the hearth were comforting to me. I unwrapped the last of the previous week's bread and cut a chunk, and then went through to the pantry for some sharp cheese from the wheel there. I drew a mug of ale as well and sat down at the kitchen work table. The kitchen was probably the warmest room in Withywood's. The big hearth in the corner never went cold, and the heat from the baking oven in the other wall never completely left the room. I ate and drank, and kept my mind on kitchens and cooks that I had known. Then I gave up. I folded my arms on the table, put my head on them, and stared into the fire. Why, fool? Why, after all the empty years? Why didn't you come yourself? Were you in danger as the messenger had implied? And if you were, why didn't you send a map or instructions as to how to find you? Did you think I wouldn't come to your aid? I woke to thudding that vibrated through my skull. Cook Nutmeg had an immense mound of bread dough on the work table and was kneading it. Every so often, she would lift one edge of it, fold it over, and then hit it energetically with the palms of her hands. I drew a deep breath and sat up straight. For a moment, I felt a boy again, watching the pre-dawn activity of Buckkeep's great kitchen. But it was only Withywood's, and instead of a score of workers, there were only six. Tarvia turned from stirring the morning's porridge and met my gaze with a raised eyebrow. "Ale a bit stronger than you expected?" "I couldn't sleep. I came down here, and then I suppose I found I could sleep." She nodded, and then respectfully but firmly informed me, "You're in our way." I nodded back. "I'll move," I said, and stood stifling a yawn. "It smells so good in here," I told her, and both of them gifted me with smiles. Tarvia spoke. "It will smell even better when it's brought out to the table. Lady Shun seemed a bit disappointed with our rustic efforts yesterday, so I've told the help that we need to shine today, if that pleases you, sir." "Shine? As would make our Lady Molly proud. Time to lift up our heads and be a proper household again. Ravel has been chewing his own teeth over how things had begun to go down, so we're all glad to see you taking more of an interest in the house, sir. And it's good to have more folk here, to work and to live. Bring life back to the place."
"Life, after Molly's death."
I nodded, not sure that I agreed with her, but letting her know I valued what she was telling me. She gave me a firm nod in return, emphasizing that she was right. "Breakfast done proper won't be ready for another hour or so, sir, but I can bring you some tea if you wish."
"I do wish," I assured her, and let myself be herded out of her kitchen. My back ached, and my head ached, and I still smelled of smoke.
I rubbed my face and became aware of the growth of whiskers, one of the perils of trying to be clean-shaven for my daughter. I'd have to tend to my face every morning now. "Tarvia," I called after her, "you can wait on the tea. I'll ring when I'm ready." Coward that I was, I found one of the little kitchen maids and sent her to tell my steward I'd found vermin in my daughter's bed and burned her bedding in the night. I told her to tell him to address it as he thought best, and left it at that. I fled to the steams. One of the things I missed most from my boyhood days were the steams at Buckkeep. They were a year-round comfort, warming a man through and through in the depths of winter and sweating sickness out from a body at any time of the year. They were a legacy from Buckkeep's days as a fortification, with multiple rooms and benches. There were separate chambers for the guardsmen, prone to be rowdy and pugilistic after a night's drunk, and some for the castle servants, and a different set for the nobility.
The men's steams at Withywood's paled by comparison. There was a single chamber, not much larger than my bedchamber, with benches round the walls. The great brick oven that heated it was at one end of the room, and a brick-lined pool of water was in the centre. It never pulsed with heat like the steams at Buckkeep, but a determined man could do a good job of cleansing himself there. All the folk at Withywood's, great and small, used the steams. This morning, Lynn the shepherd was in there with two of his grown sons. I nodded at all three, in little mood for talk. But Lynn immediately asked if I had authorized the burning of the brush pile in the night. And so I had to tell the tale of biting insects in my daughter's bedding, and that I had wanted it out of the house and burned immediately. He nodded gravely, and allowed that he was a man who understood dealing swiftly with such pests, but I saw the looks his sons exchanged with each other. For a short time Lynn was silent, and then he asked me if I'd given leave to anyone to camp in the sheep pastures. When I told him no, he shook his head again.
"Well, it may just have been random travellers then, and not much to worry if you were the one that set the fire. This morning I found the top railing on one fence taken down, and the tracks of at least three horses crossing the pasture. No real harm done, and nothing taken. Looks like they left the way they came. The flocks were fine, and I didn't even hear Daisy or the other dogs bark in the night. So perhaps they were just folk stopping for a time to rest."
"Did they make a camp there, in a snowy pasture?" He shook his head. "I'll walk out later and take a look." He shrugged one shoulder.
"Nothing to see, just horse tracks. I already put the fence railing back up."
I nodded and wondered. Simple travellers, or those who had hunted my messenger? I doubted they were the hunters. Folk who had killed one messenger and condemned another to a horrible death were unlikely to simply pause in a pasture on the pursuit. I would still look at the tracks, but doubted I'd find anything more than what Lynn had. Chapter 20. The Morning After.
There is a time for an assassin to kill and disappear. There is a time for public killings, and there is a time to kill in secret. For the purposes of a lesson, a killing may be public, and the body left for others to deal with. Sometimes it is better to assassinate in private, and then display the body in a way that will shock, terrify, or admonish others. Most difficult of all, perhaps, is the assassination that must be completely concealed. Not just the killing, but the resultant body. The purpose of this is sometimes to create uncertainty, or to avoid blame, or to make it appear that the subject has fled or abandoned his duties. Thus it becomes clear that simply training your assassin to kill efficiently is not enough. One must instill judgment, discipline, and self-effacement to create a useful tool.
Singal's Lessons in Murder, translated from the Chalcedian.
I woke to grey light coming in the windows. I was on the couch where my mother had birthed me, wrapped in a blanket. On my father's regular chair, near the fire, a blanket was neatly folded. I could tell that the fire had recently been fed. I lay still, thinking of all the ways my life had changed in one day. Shun had arrived, and the pale messenger. My father had seen me as useful and even intelligent as I helped him bring her in. He'd trusted me to follow his instructions, and then Shun had distracted him with her silly complaints, and we'd lost our chance with the messenger. When we had concealed her death, I had been shocked, but I'd also felt that he valued me. Yet the moment Shun was frightened, he had left my side and forgotten me completely as he ran off to see her hysterics. I threw my blanket off me and onto the floor and glared at my father's empty chair as I sat up. Everyone wanted him to take care of someone else besides me. Take care of Shun and protect her. The pale girl wanted him to go off and look for a lost son. Was anyone telling him to pay attention to his own daughter, because otherwise there was no one else in the world who would watch over her? No. Except maybe Nettle, and she thought I was an idiot. Well, perhaps not an idiot, and perhaps that was my own fault for never letting her share my thoughts. But it still didn't bode well for my future if I went to live with her. Or would Riddle go back to Buckkeep and tell her I wasn't as feeble-minded as she thought? If Riddle went back to Buckkeep Castle, he seemed very intent on protecting Shun too, and Shun seemed very eager to keep him by her side. I scowled at that thought. I was not sure why, but I was certain that Riddle was the property of my older sister. In that moment, Shun became not only the outsider, but the enemy. And my absent father was little better. Swiftly, I constructed my resentment and believed in it. Silently seething with anger at all of them, I returned to my bedchamber. I was not pleased to find it full of folk scrubbing the walls and floors. The smell of vinegar was strong. All bedding had vanished from the servant's bed frame. And when I threaded my small way among the unfamiliar servants, I found that most of my clothing chests had been emptied as well. I was pleased at the idea that my things would be returned washed and freshed, and less pleased that so little was left for me to choose from. Nor did I like how the four newly hired women and the beefy man helping them with the heavier lifting paused in their cleaning tasks to stare at me. They were the intruders here, not I. Yet stare they did, and not one offered to help me as I struggled with the heavy lid of the chest. I contented myself with grabbing whatever garments I could reach. I carried them off with me and went back to the relative privacy of my mother's room to change out of my nightrobe. I changed hastily there, squatting behind the screens in the corner. The tunic was from summer and a bit too small for me, shorter than my mother would have allowed me to wear. The leggings bagged at the knee and bottom. I consulted the small pieces of looking-glass set in a decorative lamp cover. My shorn hair stood up like the stubble in a harvested field. I looked more like a serving boy than our serving boys did. I took a deep breath and refused to think of Shun's fine clothing and hair combs and rings and scarves. My new red nightrobe was on the floor. I picked it up and shook it out. I gathered it in my arms and smelled it. My mother's scent had faded, but was still there. I folded it and hid it behind a stool. I myself would wash it out and scent it with one of her rose sachets. I went in search of my father. I found him, Shun, and Riddle at breakfast in the dining room. I was surprised to see the table made up so formally. There were covered serving dishes and two pots of tea on the table. An empty place setting awaited me. I wondered if it would be like this every day now that Shun was living with us. They had almost finished eating. I came into the room quietly and slipped into the empty place. Shun was talking, some nonsense about warding off ghosts with cups of green tea. I let her finish. Before my father could speak, I observed to him, "You had breakfast without me. It hurt me deeply, and I didn't try to hide that. It was a small ritual we had shared since we had been left alone after my mother's death. Whatever else happened, he woke me in the morning, and we had breakfast together." He looked very draggled and weary, even though he had shaved and his shirt was clean. But I refused to feel sorry for him as he said,
"It was a late night for all of us. I thought you would want the extra sleep."
"You should have wakened me to see if I wanted to join you."
"I probably should have,"
my father said quietly. He spoke in a voice that told me he wasn't pleased we were having this discussion in front of Riddle and Shun. Suddenly, I regretted it.
"Children need more sleep than adults. Everyone knows that,"
Shun informed me helpfully. She picked up her teacup and observed me over the rim as she sipped from it. She had the eyes of an evil cat. I looked at her levelly. "And everyone knows that ghosts are bound to the site of their deaths. Your Rono is wherever you left him. Ghosts don't follow people about." If she had been a cat, she would have hissed at me. Her lips pulled back from her teeth in just the same way. But if she had been a cat, she would have known the noise in the walls was just another cat. I looked at her as I asked my father, "Is there any food left for me?" He looked at me without speaking and then rang a small bell. A servant I didn't know hurried into the room. My father directed him to bring breakfast for me. I think Riddle was trying to be soothing when he asked me,
"Well, Bee, and what are your plans for the day?"
Shun narrowed her eyes when he spoke to me, and I knew instantly what I wanted to do that day. Keep Riddle so busy he would have no time for Shun. I lifted my chin and smiled at him. "Since you are here, and my father has been so busy preparing for our guest, and with the repairs to the house that he has little time for me, I wondered if you would show me how to ride a horse today." His eyes widened with genuine pleasure.
"With your father's permission, I would be delighted."
My father looked stunned. My heart sank. I should have known that asking Riddle to teach me would hurt his feelings. I had aimed for Shun and struck my father instead. Not that I had missed Shun. Her narrowed eyes made her look even more like a dunked cat. My father spoke.
"I thought you said that you didn't want to learn to ride, that you didn't feel comfortable with the idea of sitting on another creature's back and telling it where to go."
I had said that when I was much smaller, and it still made perfect sense to me. But I would not have said it in front of Shun. I felt the burn rise to my cheeks.
"Such a peculiar idea,"
Shun exclaimed, and laughed delightedly. I stared at my father. How could he have said that aloud and in front of a relative stranger? Had he done it on purpose because I'd hurt his feelings? I spoke stiffly. "I still feel it is unfair, simply because we are humans and can force animals to obey us, that we should do it. But if I am ever to visit my sister at Buckkeep Castle, it is a thing I must learn." Riddle seemed oblivious of the current sweeping past him as he smiled and said,
"And a visit from you would please your sister more than anything, I think, especially when she sees how well you speak."
"Did she use to stutter then, or lisp?"
If Shun was trying to disguise her disdain for me, she was doing a poor job of it. Riddle looked at her directly, his face solemn and his voice grave.
"She spoke little, that was all.
If Bee wishes you to teach her to ride, I'm sure I'm pleased,"
my father said.
"There is a horse in the stables, not a pony, but a small horse. I chose her for Bee when she was 5, when I thought I might persuade her to try riding, but she refused. She's a mare, a dapple grey, with one white hoof."
I looked at him, but he was hidden behind his eyes. He had chosen a horse for me all those years ago, and when I had wriggled and squirmed when he tried to put me in the saddle, he had given up that plan with no rebuke for me. Why had he kept the mare? Because he had kept the hope. I had not meant to hurt him. "One white hoof. Try him," I said quietly. "I am sorry that I did not try her all those years ago. I'm ready now." He nodded, but did not smile.
"I will be pleased to see you learn, Bee, regardless of who teaches you. But there will be no visits to Buckkeep Castle just yet. Very early this morning, I received word that your new tutor will soon begin his journey to join us here. It would be peculiar indeed if he left Buckkeep Castle and arrived here to find you gone to Buckkeep."
"My new tutor? What news is this? When was this decided?" I felt as if the room tilted around me.
"Years ago."
My father spoke tersely now.
"His name is FitzVigilant. This has been planned for some time. He will arrive within the next 10 days.
He suddenly looked as if something pained him.
"And a room must be ready for him as well."
"FitzVigilant,"
Riddle said quietly. He did not shoot my father an odd look or raise his brows, but I heard an affirming note in his voice and knew that he was informing my father that he knew more than he had been told.
I had heard that Lord Vigilant thought his younger sons were old enough to come to court.
Indeed, that is the case,
my father confirmed,
though I am told that it was more his wife's decision than his. Indeed, I have heard that Lord Vigilant was surprised to hear of it.
Lady Shun's gaze was darting from one to the other. Did she guess that more was being conveyed than she was privileged to know? In that moment, I scarcely cared. I was caught in a daze. The memories from my earliest babyhood, like the memories I have from within my mother, are floating memories. They exist, but they are not anchored to my daily life. Only when a scent or a sound or a taste wakens one does it cascade to the front of my mind. In this case, it was a name. Fitz Vigilant. The name had rung in my ears like a bell, and suddenly my awareness was flooded with a memory. It came with a scent of my mother's milk and a fire of applewood and cedar logs, and for a long moment I was an infant in a cradle, hearing that name spoken in a youth's sullen voice. It is one thing to have a vague memory from one's childhood. It is quite another for the aware mind to put that memory into context and offer it back. He had crept into my cradle room when I was a baby. My father had stopped him from touching me. My father had spoken of poisons and threatened to kill him if he came near me again. And now he was to be my tutor? My mind boiled with questions. The new servant whisked back into the room and set before me a bowl of porridge, 2 boiled eggs, and a small dish of stewed apples. A touch of cinnamon on the apples fragranced the room. Had Tavia done this especially for me, or was it for everyone? I lifted my gaze. They were all looking at me. I was in a quandary. Had my father forgotten the name of the boy who had come to my cradle that night? Did he think he had changed? Why would he be my tutor? I took a spoonful of the apples and thought before I asked, "And you think Fitz Vigilant will teach me well?" Shun had been sipping her tea. She clattered her cup onto the saucer. She looked at Riddle as she shook her head in consternation. In a conspiratorial voice, as if she did not intend my father and me to overhear, she opined, "Never have I heard a child question her father's decisions. Had I objected to even one of my grandmother's plans for me, I am sure she would have slapped me and dismissed me to my room." It was neatly done. I could not defend myself without appearing more spoiled and petulant than she had already painted me. I drank some milk, looking at my father over the rim of my cup. He was angry. His face had not changed at all, and perhaps, I thought, only I could tell that he had been provoked. By Shun or by me, I wondered. Even his voice was normal, as he said,
"My relationship with B is different, then, from what you had with your grandparents. I have always encouraged her to think, and to discuss with me our plans for her."
He took a sip of his own tea and added,
"I cannot imagine slapping her. Ever."
His gaze briefly kissed mine, and tears stung my eyes. I had been so jealous, so sure that he was favoring Shun. But that swift look offered me something that went beyond even being my father. He was my ally. When he sat down the cup, he nodded to me pleasantly and added,
"For a number of years, Lord Shade has especially prepared Fitz Vigilant to be your tutor, B."
He tipped me a wink that no one else saw.
"Try him."
"I shall," I promised. I owed my father that. I focused and summoned a smile to my face. "It will be so exciting to learn new things."
"I am very pleased to hear you say that,"
he replied, and I almost felt the warmth of the thoughts he sent me. Shun spoke over my words.
"The messenger announcing his coming arrived last night, from Lord Shade, but I heard nothing, and I assure you I was not asleep. I found not the least bit of rest last night. Did the messenger say anything of me? Was there word for me from him?"
"The message came quietly and was only about the tutor,"
my father said. His words said one thing, while his tone pointed out that it was not her business. For myself, I understood that Lord Shade had skilled the information to him. Truly, my father had had a very busy night, and had every excuse to look haggard. I kept the smile on my face from becoming smug, as I realized that I obviously knew something that Shun did not, which was that my father and Lord Shade shared the skill magic. That satisfied me, and I resolved that for now I would ask no more questions. I put my attention on my food, and listened to Riddle and my father speak, and Shun interrupt with questions that related only to herself. The workmen would return by noon and resume the renovations of Withywood's manor. Shun hoped they would not begin work too early. She disliked being wakened by noise. My father had informed Revel that he must prepare chambers for Scribe FitzVigilant. Shun wondered which chambers he would be given. The subject of the imaginary bedbugs came up, and Shun expressed horror and demanded that she be given entirely new bedding. My father assured her that new bedding would be part of the renovation of the Yellow Suite. She asked if the Yellow Suite must remain yellow, as she much preferred mauve or lavender. That made me lift my eyes. I watched my father and Riddle exchange looks of consternation. My father's brow wrinkled.
"But the Yellow Suite has always been the Yellow Suite,"
he said, as if that explained everything.
"There is a purple suite at the other end of the wing, if I recall correctly,"
Riddle offered.
"You would be quite a distance from the rest of the household, but if you wish it..."
my father began. I tried not to smile. I ate the last of the cooling porridge, as Shun objected. "But I do like the view from those windows. Cannot you simply paint the walls of my chambers and change the hangings to a more restful color?"
"Just because it has always been the Yellow Suite does not mean that it must remain so." "But it's the Yellow Suite."
My father remained baffled by Shun's failure to understand this, while she hammered at him to make him see that yellow might be painted mauve. While they were distracted, I slipped away from the table. My father and Riddle were, I think, peripherally aware that I had vanished, but neither of them stopped me. My bedchamber was bare enough that I could have painted it any color and not worried about furniture or tapestries or rugs. Something meant to kill bed vermin smoldered on the hearth, giving off a thick smoke. The wooden skeletons of the bed remained. My clothing chests had been removed to the corridor. I retreated there and rummaged again for warmer clothing before I ventured outside. The rain had paused, and a wind, warm for this time of year, was moving over the land. I went first to where my father and I had made our bonfire the night before. It had burned hot. There was only white ash in the center of a ring of partially burned sticks and branches. I took up one of the sticks and stirred the white ash. Beneath it, black coals opened red spark eyes at me as I woke them. I saw no bits of bones, not even the round of a skull I had expected to find. I wondered if my father had been here before me at the very edge of dawn. I kicked some of the ends of the branches back into the center and waited. A thin tendril of smoke began to rise, and eventually the fire woke to flames again. I stood, watching it burn, recalling all that our peculiar visitor had said, and wondering if my father would act on it or forget it now that she was gone. An unexpected son had been foretold, and someone had once believed that my father fulfilled that foretelling. Clearly, I still did not know his full tale. I wondered if I could safely be bolder about stealing his papers and reading them while he was enslaved to the repairs on Withywoods. I decided I would have to. I walked past the sheep pens on the way back to the house. On a lichened rock in the middle of the close-cropped pasture, a lean black kitten was hunched, looking down at the deeper grass. He had two white paws that I could see, and a crook in his tail. He was hunting. I stopped and stood silently. I watched his muscles tighten, and then, like an arrow released from the bow, he dived down onto something in the grass. He hit it hard with both his front paws and then shot his head in to kill it with a swift bite. He looked up at me, and I suddenly knew he had been aware of my scrutiny the whole time. The dark grey mouse was limp in his jaws. "I know where there are plenty of mice. Mice fat on cheese and sausages," I called to him. He looked at me silently, as if considering my words, and then turned and trotted purposefully away with his prey. He had grown up fast, I thought to myself. Cats do. Once a cat can hunt, he can get all he needs. Then his life is his own. The thought came so clearly to my mind that I almost believed it was my own. "I have need of a hunter such as you," I called after him. He did not pause as he trotted away. I watched him go and thought that my needs meant little to anyone but me. What I needed, I would have to obtain for myself.
Chapter 21. Search for the Sun.
The first task a lady must undertake in her new home is the establishment of respect for herself. This may be more difficult than one might expect, especially if one is moving into her new residence after wedding, and one's husband's mother is still the mistress of the household. But, startling as it might seem, it can be even more difficult for the lady who takes charge of her bachelor husband's residence after wedding. In a case where servants have become accustomed to there being only a master of the house, the new lady may find it difficult to wrest control or even gain respect from the upper echelon of servants. Stewards and cooks are notoriously hard to deal with in this regard. The new mistress of the house will rapidly tire of hearing, "But this is how it's always been done here." Even worse is to be told by a servant, "This is how the master prefers it to be done." If it is not addressed immediately, the new lady of the house will find herself delegated to the same status as a visiting minstrel. Often, the best course is simply to dismiss the heads of staff and begin afresh with servants of the lady's choosing. But in cases where the master is attached to older servants, the lady must be direct and firm in taking immediate control. It is a mistake simply to accede to what is first offered to her. Immediately challenge the menus, the flower arrangements, the attire of the staff. In other words, establish control of your domestic domain from the moment you step in the door.
Lady Celestia's Guide to Manners. I found Revel already busy with the workmen. He was outside the door of the rooms that were to be Shun's, berating them for the mud they had tracked in. I waited until he had finished, and then mentioned to him that perhaps Lady Shun would want a different colour of room. Could the yellow suite be painted to accommodate her? He looked at me as if I were daft. But then the rainbow would be out of order.
I beg your pardon?
By Lady Patience's decree, years ago, the seven suites were painted to reflect the order of colours in the rainbow. Thus it begins with red, then orange, yellow is followed by green, then blue, and
purple. Is the purple suite in good repair?
The crease between his eyes deepened.
As good a repair as I've been able to keep it in, given the budget you've allotted me.
He looked down on me, struggling to hide his disapproval over how little consideration I'd given to the estate over the years. I made a hasty decision. Send for Lady Shun. Let her select the room with the colour that best suits her. And prepare the green suite as well. No, wait. You are right, Revel. Bring me a list of what must be done for each of the suites in the main house in order to meet your approval. Let us begin, as we should have years ago, to make them right, one after another. Oh, and there will be another guest coming to stay with us, arriving in 10 days or less. Fitz Vigilant is to be tutor to Lady B, and perhaps to some of the other estate